From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
Obama ends the war on terror. Eric Holder versus the First Amendment. Plus, gay Boy Scouts, the Fed, Apple versus the IRS, and A Tale of Two Cities. The deeper meaning of Eric Garcetti and Anthony Weiner. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, your moderator, holding down the political center, coming from San Francisco today. Robert Scheer is on the left. Special guest returning, conservative Stuart Stevens on the right. Stuart Stevens, of course, the senior advisor to Mitt Romney's last campaign, currently a columnist for The Daily Beast, as well as an accomplished screenwriter, author, et cetera, et cetera. Welcome back, Stuart. It's great to have you join the conversation.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And rounding out our incredible crew is Chrystia Freeland, digital editor of Thomson Reuters. Welcome back to you, Chrystia. It is one of those action-packed weeks where we couldn't make up our mind. There was so much news to talk about, but we determined that if we compromised on quality and really did the commentary in haiku, we could provide the kind of insight that our listeners have come to expect. So, mad dash through the week. The war on terror, Robert Scheer. Big speech from Barack Obama on Thursday. What did you make of it? What's new, and where does this leave us in this? It was quite an eloquent statement of where he thinks where we are.
Well, it was an important retreat from the stupidity of the position taken by the people from the Pentagon just only a week ago that even shocked John McCain, where they said they had the authorization after 9/11 to go to war any time, for any reason, for any length. And they talked about this war on terror being 10 to 20 years in duration at the least, and so forth. And what he did is finally stated clearly that this the policy that he inherited from Bush, but has pursued very vigorously, is extremely dangerous and also unconstitutional, since it's Congress that is supposed to have the power to declare war, and the president is supposed to be the commander-in-chief. On that level, it was good. However, as Bob Blum points out in Truthdig this week, he's very good on these issues. Media Benjamin was absolutely right in protesting. He has the power right now to close Guantanamo. He's not doing it. He did not go as far as had to be done on drones. If due process should be afforded Americans attack, why not other people? He did not really come to grips with that issue. And once again, he was waffling, really, on what he will do. The way he stated it, he can do nothing about Guantanamo and yet seem to have appeal to some human rights people.
Stuart Stevens, what did you make of it? I mean, I always have wanted, and I actually thought Obama did this some years ago, to kind of abandon the language of the war on terror, because that would put us into this, you know, it would be infinite. And in fact, we are going to be in something for decades where we have to be vigilant against groups that want to kill us. But the war metaphor to me, and some of the stuff it implied, is off it and kind of skews our politics. But what did you find of interest in the president's remarks?
Well, at first, I found it very confusing. I don't think that the only way that it seems to me that one side can end a war is if you surrender. So you just can't sort of unilaterally get up there and say, well, the war on terror is over. Unless the other side agrees that it's over. And as far as I know, that agreement hasn't been reached. He seemed to be all over the map, which I think is a lot of the different internal conflicts that he has that Bob mentioned. He's continued a lot of the Bush policies and expanded them, which I think in many ways is not a bad thing. I think the drone policy is something that most Americans support for a good reason. It's an asymmetrical war that favors us. So I think it's sort of an attempt to articulate an unformed thought that he has that was sort of more different feelings than a thought-out policy.
And yet, Chrystia, one of the things that I found of interest, and I guess a little bit different than Stuart, is that in trying to put some limits, at least rhetorical and legal limits he described in the speech on the use of drones, we need to do that in some way as we head toward a world where, you know, a decade or two decades from now, there are going to be thousands and thousands of drones in the air. China's going to have fleets of drones. Who else knows who's going to have drones? And if we don't set a different example or lay down the rules that we're prepared to live by and want the world to live by, we're going to be in a kind of a free-for-all. But what do you make of his talk?
Well, look, on specific and very important issues like the drones, like Guantanamo, I actually agree with both Bob and Stuart that there wasn't a complete, fully thought out, fully convincing policy laid out. But I disagree with Stuart very much that the core of the speech was somehow unthought through and a feeling rather than a clear idea. I think it was a very clear idea and a very important idea. And that was that there's a difference between having threats and facing them and fighting with them and being in a state of war. Being in a state of war is a very, very particular condition. It's a condition when all countries limit civil liberties to some extent because the existential threat is so great. And as the president said, I thought clearly and importantly, it is dangerous to America as a country to maintain that state indefinitely. So I think that was really, really clear, really, really important. And I do think it's important, you know, for Americans at this moment to reflect that facing a terrorist threat is not unique to America, and it's not unique to this moment in history, right? I mean, terrorism was around in the 19th century. And yes, it's very bad. It's very evil people who are doing it, but it is different from an all-out war. And I think it's actually really terrific that the president, you know, began articulating that and defining that.
Let us know what you think about the president's speech and where we are in the war on terror and drones, Guantanamo, all that was involved in that at kcrw.com/LRC. Robert Scheer, Eric Holder, the First Amendment. We've got the AP stuff that continues to push forward. The news this week that Fox reporter was really, his personal emails and other stuff kind of spied upon. Lots of folks weighing in. Len Downey, the former editor of the Washington Post, has a big piece up online on Friday as we went to air. Maybe it's running this weekend on how, comparing the Obama administration to being worse maybe perhaps than Nixon's was in terms of the way they're going after leakers. What's the right way to think about all this?
Well, I think just want to pick up on Krista's point, this connection. You destroy democracy by engaging in this kind of hysteria that both the Bush and now until today, I guess, the Obama administration has done. And the main victims are going to be the people in your own society. We had a rather minor attack, actually, compared to what just about every other nation in the world has experienced. Certainly not just from terror, but from enemies perceived and real and so forth. They can all claim they've been under attack. We actually are the most stable country in the world and the least vulnerable to attacks. Yet after 9/11, we threw everything aside. We have this disgrace of Guantanamo. We're being keeping people for 11 years that have never been charged with a crime. And Amnesty International has a worldwide appeal that went out today to free some of these people. We are one of the terrible states when it comes to human rights. So the case of AP, the case of Fox News, is another example. In the name of fighting terror, in the name of secrecy, you can cover up lying, you cover up your own deceit, you destroy democracy, and then you go after the reporters who are trying to find something out that the public has every right to know. What is your policy? What are the documents? What information do you have? And when they do their job, they're suddenly made the enemy, and all of the coercive power of the state and its surveillance mechanism, these totalitarian means of control, are then going to be targeted on people who are pursuing their rights under the constitutional guarantee of a free press. And I agree what Obama has done in this area, I'm sorry to say, I never thought I would utter these words, is worse than Nixon.
Stuart, I know you've been following this stuff and being concerned about the AP and the Fox stuff. How are you looking about
it? Well, first off, Bob's comment, call me crazy. I think this is between killing people that are trying to kill Americans and trying to make reporters criminals. There's a link of the difference there that most Americans can perceive. What's extraordinary here is that they are doing something that Nixon never did, which is criminalizing behavior. of reporters. That is normal behavior of reporters. And I think what's going to be fascinating here to watch is how do other journalists respond to this? Is this finally going to be the moment in which they step back and they look at the behavior here of the Obama administration? They begin to see patterns. And I would suggest that there are the same administration that does this is the same administration that does the IRS, that there are links here, same administration that handles not being very disclosing about the Benghazi emails, that there's a pattern here. But I think that hopefully now, finally, journalists will be able to be able to look at this with a bit more realistic, more open-minded approach.
You know, Christia, on things like the James Rosen thing, the Fox reporter who, you know, whose emails were looked at, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it's not illegitimate for, or let me ask the question. It doesn't seem illegitimate to me that the administration doesn't want officials leaking classified information to reporters. The reporter's doing his job, but the idea that someone who's in the executive branch and is leaking information they're not supposed to be sharing, is there anything wrong with trying to clamp down on that?
Well, here, actually, I'm afraid, Matt, you're going to find me in violent agreement with Bob and Stuart. I do think that they've crossed a line here. And I think Stuart made a really good point, actually, which was that it is important for journalists to be as tough on Obama and the Obama administration over this stuff as journalists would have been had this been a Republican, say, Bush administration. I think that's really, really important, and important that Obama not get a pass. I do think that this is pretty outrageous. I mean, to lighten the tone of sort of outrage, I will quote you my favorite tweet, and I apologize to the author of this smart tweet because I forget who it was, but someone tweeted, I have a simple solution to all of this. From now on, all reporters should just CC Eric Holder on every email they send to anyone in the administration. And that's kind of what it boils down to. And that's absurd, and it's wrong. And speaking as a Canadian who is very fond of America, I would say it's really anti-American. You guys are the ultimate free press guys.
And yet the one thing I'd say, and we're going to have to move on, Bob, but I think the idea of criminalizing the behavior of reporters is obviously crazy, outrageous, et cetera. The impulse of an administration not to have members of the administration leak, you know, classified security information, I think is a legitimate concern. And leaks in general, the idea that administrations are paranoid about this. When I worked in the White House, you end up having no open discussion because if there's 10 people in a room, the president knows that it's going to the Washington Post the next day.
So fire those people instead of persecuting their reporters. If your administration
I agree with you. Don't persecute the reporters. I heard that. I'm saying it's a legitimate interest of people trying to govern that the people around them don't leak, especially classified goods. Last word on this, Bob?
Yeah, the founders, beginning with George Washington, warned us about, you know, that if you get into imperial ventures, you will not be a republic of free people. So national security is really the great threat. You say you are fighting this war in which our life hangs in the balance, and therefore truth becomes the enemy. And any working journalist will tell you they are leaked to all the time. I was told by Edward Teller the results of the cottage test on Star Wars weaponry was the highest secret in the government. He just routinely leaked it to me when I worked at the LA Times because he favored the program. It's the norm. And what they do is they, in order to intimidate reporters who are going after stories they don't want to get out, they're willing to sacrifice the basic principle of a free press. That's really what's at issue here.
Let us know what you think about the Eric Holder's war on the First Amendment at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, gay Boy Scouts, Apple versus the IRS, plus the rise again of Anthony Weiner. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller of The Washington Post, Robert Scheer of TruthDig.com. Special guest Stuart Stevens, formerly of the Romney campaign, now of The Daily Beast and others, and returning guest Christia Freeland, digital editor of Thomson Reuters. Stuart, let me spend one last second, a nanosecond, on the DOJ stuff. One of the things that was interesting to me is that the in the AP subpoenas or the scrutiny they gave, they actually didn't give the heads up they're supposed to give to the Associated Press, which is the normal rules of engagement when justice is trying to do this. They just went right to Verizon and the phone companies to do the records. So there was no opportunity to negotiate the scope, et cetera, which is supposed to be the way, if there's a legitimate national security interest, et cetera, the Justice Department's supposed to engage on this, which does, again, play into this notion of Holder's Justice Department overreaching. What's your last word
Look,
on
this? My feeling is this is done with the confidence. It is the Obama administration, in many cases, treats the press like an abused spouse. And they are confident that regardless of what they will do, there will be a pattern here that they will come back and they will attempt to explain to the world that, well, normally he's not like this. He just gets upset and this terrible things happen, but really he's a good guy. And it's a pattern that they depend upon, and they've been well served by this. And it happens, hopefully, now it'll be broken. Because this is just, I think, a bridge too far for a lot of reporters to take, and it'll change this pattern. But that has been a pattern.
Let's move on to the Boy Scouts in the news. Christia, the announcement that the Boy Scout organization will now allow gay Boy Scouts, although the question of whether openly gay people can serve as leaders in the Boy Scouts was deferred. This is causing lots of controversy within the Boy Scout community, people threatening to leave it, et cetera. What do you make of this kind of quick round the horn on this kind of cultural milestone for one of those iconic kind of American institutions?
I think it's great. And I think that this, you know, the story of full human rights being extended to gay and lesbian people is one of the really bright spots in the world right now. So, you know, good for the Boy Scouts and good for us.
Robert, I saw one of the things that struck me in the coverage on Friday was that there was one woman quoted who, you know, like her whole family was going to withdraw, their three sons, et cetera, from the Boy Scouts because of this and maybe being part of starting a rival group because they were trying to raise their boys with Christian values. And it does strike me that, you know, the accepting people on their own terms and their humanity is a Christian value. And that seemed poignant and sad to me that this is the tension. But what do you make of it?
Well, Christians differ on this. Obviously, that's why Protestants and Catholics in Ireland killed each other over their interpretation. So if people want to have a religious movement, then they can't call themselves the Boy Scouts. Because the Boy Scouts use a lot of public agencies. They expect the general public to support their activities. They use facilities, schools, all the time. And so the real issue here is this is a quasi-public organization that wants to retain that connection in the community. If they want to go off to be a purely private enterprise with their values, that's, I guess, their business, and the courts can deal with that separately. The reason the Boy Scouts are under pressure to change is, as I say, they want to be perceived as this universal organization. And while I applaud their decision, they clearly continue to hold to this bigotry because they will not let adults who are gay participate in the Boy Scouts. The assumption is somehow heterosexual adults can contain, will not be pederasts, but gay adults will be. It's a repeating the deepest prejudice, and it's unacceptable. It's totally unacceptable. And until they change that policy, they should not be able to have access to public facilities on that kind of basis that discriminate.
Stuart, what do you make of it?
Look, I think scouting is a fantastic program, and anything that gets more people involved in scouting, I'm for. Part of this is recognizing the reality. There's obviously been, just as there were in the military before they changed their policy, there were gay members of the military. There's obviously gay Boy Scouts out there that are before this policy was changed. So part of it is just recognizing reality and making those kids more comfortable, which I think is a great thing. There's a large cultural shift here. I think it's good for the Boy Scouts, and I think that these things, you know, these changes are often bumpy. And I think a lot, it's just one of these moments where mutual respect of difference of opinion has never been more valuable.
Let us know what you think about the decision by the Boy Scouts to allow gay troopers but not gay adults to serve in their ranks at kcrw.com/LRC. Christia Freeland, Apple, the IRS, taxes. What do you make of it? You know the issues. They were grilled this week, Apple CEO Tim Cook, same time that the raising the whole corporate tax question. Then there's the question of the IRS, which is atop the news in every way, every week now these days. What interests you this week in these matters?
I think the Apple story is really, really important and long overdue that we focus on it. And it's important for two reasons. One is, you know, it highlights the way in which the fact that business and capital have become global, but government and taxation are national, is really causing huge problems in the financing of government. You know, one thing that was really striking to me is when you talk to tax experts, they will say, well, you know what? Apple's schemes were actually rather conservative compared to what the law allows you to do. And the net result of that is, you know, the headline corporate tax rate may be 35%, but the reality is U.S. companies have been paying increasingly low rates of tax, say, compared to the 1960s. The effective tax levied on U.S. corporations has been falling very sharply. And, you know, at the end of the day, either that means government has to do a lot less or others have to pick up the burden. And those others are going to end up being the individuals or the small businesses, which do not have access to these opportunities to move their money around the world. So I think that is really actually, I think that's the most important story of the week. And I would really emphasize Apple is not the culprit here because all companies do it because the law allows them to do it. The problem is the system, and people really have to wake up to that and focus on that because, you know, it's pointless to complain about the budget deficit or to complain about shrinking social services when you are allowing your tax base to erode so shockingly.
Robert, what do you make of the Apple news?
Well, first of all, I disagree with Chris. And it's the system. Yes, it's the system that these multinational corporations own and control. My goodness, the New York Times just had a story about how all the new financial regulation bills are being written word for word by Citibank, by the lobbyists for these other huge corporations. So the system that sucks is one that they design because it benefits them. I feel some personal anger on this because I've had to dip into my own retirement funds to support the activity that I do, and I pay 40% living in California. So it's infuriating that these other people don't pay that. It is an incredible scandal. The contradiction, and it's the biggest contradiction we have in the world today, is these multinational corporations. If they didn't depend upon the power of the state, of their home state, our army, okay, our troops, our interference for their rights, our protection of copyright, they demand that the U.S. government be out there battling for them, that the blood of Americans be shed for them, and yet in their operations there, they don't want to pay for it. They're stateless. So let them go live on some offshore island and see how well they do when the pirates arrive, but don't depend upon American taxpayers and the American government to support their activity.
See, I see this stuff differently, and we could do a whole show on this, but I think corporate taxes, payroll taxes, corporate income taxes are just the wrong way to raise revenue in a modern economy, and that they're job-killing. The corporate taxes are paid by shareholders and employees ultimately, and if the shareholders are higher income, have a more progressive income tax, but the corporate tax is not the smartest way we should be raising revenue in a global economy. Stuart, I know you're interested in where our time is short, but there's like a cultural angle between Apple and the IRS news this week that you found fascinating.
Well, I mean, I think you have Apple is a company where people want to work there. They're rewarded for working there. It's a very well-managed company. It's a company that resonates success. It has very high favorables versus the IRS, which is a company where clearly they have low morale. Clearly people are despondent working there, and clearly it's terribly managed. So you look at sort of two visions of government here. Do we want more of the IRS or do we want more Apple? And that's a pretty basic choice that we have here. We should be doing everything we can in America to encourage Apple. Apple could be anywhere. It doesn't have to be an American company. Those people that don't have to live here in the United States, they can be stateless, Bob. They can. They'd be very happy on an island. But they've created tremendous wealth for Americans. And America is much better off having Apple. And they pay a fortune in taxes. And people who have made a lot of money of Apple pay a fortune in taxes.
Only a minute left. Tale of Two Cities. Eric Garcetti became mayor of L.A. this week. Anthony Weiner, not mayor, but making news because he's running in New York. Literally, Christian, just around the horn quickly, about 10, 15 seconds each. Your impressions either way on New York and L.A.'s mayoral election and development?
Well, based upon no moral or ideological reasoning, but simply fondness for the scrappy underdog, I am really enjoying the spectacle of Anthony Weiner getting back into the ring.
Bob Scheer, just a couple seconds on this. Garcetti,
yeah, there's
Weiner,
there's no connection between the two. But so let me say something about Garcetti. I think it's a good thing that he won because it's a repudiation of the power of Bill Clinton to fudge everything. Bill Clinton came in, weighed in against his opponent. His opponent has some very good qualities. But I like the fact that, that progressive voters in L.A., and it is a progressive constituency, rejected Bill Clinton as a kind of Democrat they don't have to follow.
I think Garcetti is going to be a very interesting national figure very quickly. Stuart, briefly on this?
I find it shocking that so few people voted in the Los Angeles mayor's race. And I think it is fine for Anthony Weiner to run, and I think it's fine for New Yorkers to reject him overwhelmingly.
We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. About 20-ish seconds each. Robert Scheer, your soapbox.
Yeah, I want to just mention the Boy Scouts. I actually was involved in scouting as a parent, and my son was involved in scouting. My son is gay. I was with him this week when he accepted the Webby Award for Truth Dig. I'm very proud of him, and it just underscored how absurd and vicious the anti-gay policy of not just the Boy Scout, but of the common culture has been.
Christopher Freeland, 18 seconds.
Good news from Asia and especially from Japan. Even the Wall Street Journal is now acknowledging that fiscal stimulus in Asia is working and could maybe be a good thing for the rest of the world.
About 20 seconds. Stuart Stevens.
I want to bring you back to Anthony Weiner for a second. People forget that Anthony Weiner's career was launched by the Crown Heights riots in New York, where he ran using these terribly racist flyers. That's a terrible way to launch a career. The only other person in the public venue today that has such a career launch is a Reverend Al Sharpton, who, for reasons that escape everyone, is being rehabilitated by NBC, one of the great news traditions in America. I think New Yorkers should reject Anthony Weiner for what he has done, and NBC should take Al Sharpton off the air.
On Apple, I just want to come back to the idea that grandstanding about Apple's tax planning is just not the right way in a global economy now where companies can locate anywhere to show that America is open for business and the job-creating investment that we need to attract from all over the world now. So even though there's, you know, funny, arcane things that these companies do and have brilliant minds devoted to gaming this system, the system itself is crazy. We should be funding ourselves more through energy taxes on dirty energy, consumption taxes like Europe does. Use that to fund a broader safety net, and we'd have more of a nirvana down the road. That's all the nirvana we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks to Robert Scheer, Christopher Freeland, and special guest Stuart Stevens. Laura Dimillion produced today's program with a big assist today from Joe Armstrong. Special thanks to Darren Peck at Sports Byline in San Francisco and, of course, to J.C. Swadek, our technical director. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.